Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We've got an unconventional three R's booked on the show. At 9:30, it's research on Vermont. At 10, the Flyin' Ryan Hawks Foundation. And at 10:30, we'll hear from Vermont's independent restaurants. We start off this morning discussing a program that helps our Vermont neighbors with heating assistance through the coldest part of the year. Wheels for Warmth is now in its 16th year. And we have Dick Wabi here to share the details for this year's program. Dick, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's a great day out there today. Mm-hmm. And we're really looking forward to the next couple days. Of course, it's Wheels for Warmth weekend.
Yep.
And generally on Wheels for Warmth weekend, the weather just goes to hell, right?
Well, here's crossing our fingers that Roger Hill gets it right for you this time. Dick, give us an overview of what Wheels for Warmth is.
So we do, 16 years ago, we came up with this idea that we all had tires sitting in our garages. We would see tires on the side of the road. And there was something better to do with these tires. And so what we did was we started a 2-day collection piece that we took in your tires out of your garage. And if they were good, and could be reused, and the Department of Motor Vehicles helps us and provides some inspectors. If they could be reused on Saturday, we would sell those tires. And for $20 a tire, I mean, cheap, cheap, cheap. And what it did was it created these three elements by collecting the tires in one place, selling them, the whole piece. We were able to remove old tires from the waste stream, get rid of those. We were able to provide affordable tires to those people that couldn't afford this year to go out and buy a new set of winter tires or a new set of tires for their vehicle. And then it also, with all the money that's collected and everybody volunteers their time and that whole piece, but it provides some extra funds for the emergency fuel fund. And we partnered with Brock out of Rutland, Capstone out of Central Vermont, and CBOEO to actually disperse these extra heating funds that come out of this program. So we're actually hitting three things with this 1 3-day weekend.
Well, when it got started 16 years ago, how'd it come about? Who was there that said, hey, let's do this wise thing?
Well, it was probably two or three of us. Phil Scott took the lead and said, you know, I have a large area here. I have a bunch of tires. A guy by the name of Wayne Lamberton had some tires. I had some tires. And we literally just started with the idea. We threw this together in a couple weeks. Started with the idea that we would just start to collect tires over a 2-day period. In that 16-year-ago piece, the response was so good, so great, that we were able to do it another year and then another year and another year. And over the 16 years, we've collected over, I think it's $600,000 to give to the emergency heating fund. We've collected taken over 40,000 tires out of the waste stream. And we've sold close to 20,000 tires that have been reused and help people get through the winter at a reduced rate. But really probably the drive behind the whole piece really had to do with the gentleman that's our governor today, Phil Scott,
wow,
who donated a great deal of time, energy, and the actual site we started on. And we're still there. DuBois Construction and the folks down there still support it and help us out, as well as we go down, we've branched out to the Rutland Mendon market, and the folks down at Casella Construction help us out down there.
What kind of tires do you take, Dick?
We take anything that's runnable. If you can put it on a car or a truck, we take it. You get in the tractor and motorcycle and whatnot, we're just recycling those. But and we're talking recycling. I'll tell you, this program probably wouldn't work and wouldn't be able to work without those fine folks at Casella Waste. They take in over $20,000 every year of recyclable tires or tires that over the 3-day period that have to be discarded, and they donate that whole fund, that whole piece, back to Wheels for Warmth. Mm. So that we, again, everything is done on a volunteer basis. We have several sponsors out there from, you know, Jet Service, Accurate Printing, Vermont State Employees Credit Union, Bourne's Energy, you guys, Radio Vermont. I mean, you promote and push this out bigger than anybody. The Times Argus, Rutland Herald. So you guys all help, and you can see it. Vermont's very unique in this. We all, as much as we live in our own islands in Vermont, Vermonters are very quick and free to help fellow Vermonters, and this is what makes us work.
Yeah. The tires, is there so much tread that needs to be on them? Do you take only full sets or singles, pairs? What's the deal?
We take whatever you bring in. If they don't come in a set, we're probably recycling it. It'll cost you $5 a tire.
Mm-hmm.
If it comes in a set, we're going to check it. And I've got a little home test for you if you want. If you use a nickel and it comes up to the president's head there on a nickel, then it's there's enough tread. We look for 4/32nds of tread so that we can get through a winter with these. We would like to see a season's run. And it's amazing the people that come out and help and bring their tires in. So, yes, we take twin sets. We take four tire sets.
Yep.
Whatever you have, we are willing to take and work with you on this.
All right. And you're collecting them, Thursday and Friday? So tell people where they can turn them in.
So we are collecting them Thursday and Friday. We've got actually four sites that we're collecting at. We're going to be in Montpelier at DuBois Construction. We're going to be in Mendon at Casella Construction. We've got the folks up in Stowe at the Mayo Farm Events Field.
Mm.
And then we're up at Williston at the All Cycle Field. And we're running those from like 2 to 6. And then Saturday morning, we have our two big sales, one in Rutland and one down in Montpelier at DuBois and Casella. And those sales are going to run from 8 o'clock till noon. At 10 o'clock, tires are discounted. They're already cheap. They're $20 a tire. But tires are discounted 50% from 10 to noon. So, again, stop by sometime. We've always got tires coming in on Saturday. So if you don't find what you want at 8 o'clock, stop back at around 10:30 or 11, and you'll get a super deal.
Excellent.
But we're looking forward to a great weekend, a great time out there. Again, the weather doesn't always cooperate with us, but I'll tell you, those Vermonters do, and they always are there to help their fellow Vermonters.
And WDEV will be broadcasting live from DuBois Construction on Saturday from 7 to 10. And, Dick, how much do you hope to raise? How much have you raised through the program so far through the years?
So we're at the $600,000 mark right now, and we hope to raise another $50,000 this year. As you know, we took last year off because of COVID and all the protocols. We're going back at it, and we set a goal of 50 grand this year. Hopefully we'll be able to hit that. And we accept donations, we accept whatever. But the big piece here is we're helping our neighbors with some heating assistance. We're getting those tires out of the waste stream, and we're providing affordable, safe and affordable tires to our fellow Vermonters. So this is a great thing, and we look forward to everyone's support. I know I'm going to see you. I've already checked out your car. We're going to take a set of tires right off your car, man.
Stop it, man. Hey, Dick, one more time, a quick run through the details so people know all about Wheels for Warmth.
Wheels for Warmth, it's Thursday and Friday. We'll be collecting tires down at Dubois Construction from 2 to 6 and at the Stowe Mayo Farm Events Field and in Williston on Thursday and Friday. Saturday morning, 8 to noon, we've got the big sales going on at Dubois and down at Casella. And again, we thank all our sponsors out there, Casella, Acura Printing, and Vermont State Employees Credit Union and Bourne's Energy. Come on down, give us a hand, help heat your neighbor's house, and get a good, well-rounded set of tires for your vehicle for the season. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Dick.
Thank you for allowing me the time.
Absolutely. And listeners, to learn more about Wheels for Warmth, you can go to wheelsforwarmth.com and get all the information there.
Hold it. It's .org, man.
.org. Oh, good catch. Thank you, my friend. .org. Yeah, it is. You are correct. You passed the test. He's so sharp. All right. Dick Wobbe, thanks for such an important part of the, you know, this wonderful program. We really appreciate it.
Good luck with your 3 hours today.
All right. Take care. We've been trying to solve the mystery of an audio clip that Charlotte Strasser uncovered and played last week. It was pressed on vinyl at WDEV somewhere in our past. We think it was recorded in response to a group that was pushing for the reinstitution of prohibition sometime after its appeal in 1933. So the message was in response to that and did not want prohibition reinstated. And I've got a couple more follow-ups to the info several of our listeners sent in last week. So let me see what I got here. First of all, Michelle emailed, and she wrote, the WCTU, Women's Christian Temperance Union, was active in Plainfield. My friend Jean Lathrop, late of Plainfield, did her MA thesis on the women of that group. I was her advisor. This was in the late 1970s. However, last time someone looked, they could not find her thesis in the archives at Goddard College. The WCTU was particularly against male drinking, leading to all sorts of family abuses, because it never occurred to them that women could abuse alcohol as well. Historically, they were also for a number of what we would call progressive causes, though I no longer can remember what those were. So there was a Women's Christian Temperance Union at some point in Vermont that was pushing to have alcohol prohibited. I went to Wikipedia and found this. Shortly after World War II, a national opinion survey found that, quote, about one-third of the people of the United States favor national prohibition. Upon repeal of national prohibition, 18 states continued prohibition at the state level. The last state, Mississippi, finally ended it in 1966. Now, prohibition ended in 33. But not if you were in Mississippi, 1966. Almost two-thirds of all states adopted some form of local option, which enabled residents in political subdivisions to vote for or against local prohibition. Therefore, despite the repeal of prohibition at the national level, 38% of the nation's population lived in areas with state or local prohibition. I can remember in the 80s, I lived in Dayton, Ohio, and there was an area where you could not purchase alcohol on Sundays. Some states had blue laws like that, but in Dayton, it was, again, done by kind of voting district. And one area of town, you could purchase alcohol on a Sunday. In others, you could not. In 2014, a CNN nationwide poll found that 18% of Americans, quote, believe that drinking should be illegal. So that was 7 years ago. 20%, just about, of Americans, one-fifth, believe that drinking should be illegal. That doesn't answer our question yet about exactly what that item was that Charlotte played for us. But it does tell us that there was, there were various, movements in Vermont and elsewhere, after 1933, after the repeal of prohibition, that were indeed pushing for some type of prohibition again. And we think that possibly, however that came to be, someone recorded a commercial that was a response to that. But if anyone knows for sure, we'd love to hear from you. All right. Let's see. Phones are open. I like to hear any stories about bootlegging or moonshining that may have been passed down in your family. That would be fun. I don't want to pick on the Northeast Kingdom, but I always think of the Kingdom, well, closest to Canada to begin with. But Howard Frank Mosier used to write about a lot of that in his novels. And so I always think, oh, well, the Kingdom is where it happened, but it was probably happening all across the state, all across the border. Anyway, our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. I also found this obituary of a gentleman who I interviewed a few years back, and I'd like to share it. His name was Henry Weinstock of Jericho. And I'll read it, and then I'll share how I remember him telling me the story. But he was quite an interesting individual. Henry was 87 when he passed away earlier this year. He was born in 1934 in Antwerp, Belgium, to Eugene Weinstock and Yolanda Lovi. He was a survivor of the Holocaust, narrowly escaping deportation in 1942. He and his father were with cousins, and they said goodbye. 2 hours later, the cousins and aunts and uncles were taken to Auschwitz. Luckily, Henry and his father were not. So Henry then was sheltered by the Comité de Défense des Juifs, pardon my French, an interfaith group affiliated with the Belgian resistance that was responsible for saving the lives of 3,000 Jewish children. For, I think he said, 2.5 years, he and other Jewish children were given French names, and they were in a Catholic, I think, orphanage, and saved from being taken by the Nazis. And so while hiding in the Ardennes countryside, he saw some of the fiercest fighting of World War II during the Battle of the Bulge. He was eventually reunited with his father, who survived imprisonment at Buchenwald in 1946. Henry and his father were among the first war refugees to arrive in the United States, and described what they had witnessed in his father's published memoir called Beyond the Last Path. Henry, in the U.S., became a French teacher. He was a lovely man, and I'm sorry I never reunited with him. And that should be a lesson to us. Don't let people who have great stories to tell, people who you think about, call them up. Let them know you think about them. There's another woman, Ann Bemis, in Burlington, who died earlier this year, too. And I'm sorry I never got back in touch with her after getting to know her. Let's go to the phones. We've got our friend Wade in Corinth. Hey, Wade.
Hey, good morning. So I recently acquired a annual town meeting report for 1939 for the town of Corinth.
Mm-hmm.
Article 14. Shall the license for the sale of malt and vinous beverages be granted in this town? Article 15. Shall spirituous liquors be sold in this town? And then the next three subsequent articles are, shall baseball, moving pictures, and lectures and concerts be allowed on Sundays in this town?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and I don't have the 1942 report to know how the vote came out. But
wow.
And if you dig in the dump show archives, probably right next to another blue ribbon, and it may be electronically recorded, you can probably find the Bailey Hazen Boys Rum Runner.
Oh, we did, and we played it last week.
Oh, you did? I missed
it.
Sorry.
Yeah, you probably missed it, but we did get it on for you, and it was the perfect Prohibition song. Very interesting, on the sale of liquor. So that was 6 years after Prohibition.
Yeah.
But baseball, what was it, baseball on Sundays that they were?
Yeah, baseball, moving pictures, and lectures and concerts.
Now, what's moving pictures?
A movie.
Oh, moving pictures. I like got it. Moving pictures. Yeah.
I'm sure like
oh, yeah. Moving pictures.
The moving picture show.
Right, right. Of course. The moving pictures. Oh, gotcha. Wow. How about that? So
that was quite interesting.
Yeah. Well, if you get the 1940, town meeting report, then we'll have an answer on that. But
yeah, and I'm sure it's in the records in the town clerk's office. I just haven't been able to get up there to find out. So.
Yeah.
All righty.
All right. Good thanks,
day.
Wade. Thanks. All right. So I'm wondering if maybe it was also, just that, prohibition lingered, and towns and states and towns, and districts had to kind of approve, reopening. The sale of liquor and beer and wine, and maybe that what we heard was in response to that, that it was time to end the kind of ripple effect of prohibition and to start approving the sale in places where it continued, like in Mississippi, through 1966, 33 years later. And yeah, there were a lot of dry counties. There probably still are in some places throughout the U.S., where you can't drink. And, so maybe that was what we heard was a response to that. Anyway, it was, great having Charlotte dig through the archives and find such great clips of what has happened here in the 90 years, and you will continue to hear them through the rest of the year into probably the middle of next year as we continue to celebrate 90 years here at WDEV. All right, that'll do it for the open phones. CBS News is next, and then we're going to learn about the work being done by UVM's Center for Research on Vermont. And coming up today at 1 o'clock, it's the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, followed by The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. When we do our check-ins with editors of local newspapers around Vermont on the morning news service, you've heard many of them sing the praises of the interns who are working with them thanks to UVM's Center for Research on Vermont at the Waterbury Roundabout, the Hardwick Gazette, the White River Valley Herald, and others. We're going to take this half hour to discuss some of the work of the center and hear from a few of their students who are involved with the legislative internship practice. Joining us now is the director of the Center for Research on Vermont, Richard Watts. Richard, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. We have Roanne Hawthorne, a senior at UVM and a legislative intern. Roanne, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And Emily Scheftman, who's also a legislative intern. Emily, welcome to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, listeners, to ask our guests about the Center for Research on Vermont, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Richard, give us an overview of what the Center for Research on Vermont is.
Absolutely. So the center goes back to the early 70s here at the University of Vermont, and it's meant to be a place where researchers can connect with other researchers and where we can bring attention to or make accessible research about Vermont, but not just research sort of inward-looking, but research about Vermont that says things about the larger themes in the society and the world we live in, because Vermont, as we know, is a very interesting place, and so sometimes diving into Vermont can help inform the larger questions around us.
Now, it also seems to be a major driver for student internships at UVM. So how did that come to be?
You know, because we're an old entity and because we have these great connections throughout Vermont, There's about 500 members of the center, for example, and we have been writing about and bringing attention to research in Vermont and stakeholders and policy leaders for a long time. It became a natural place as UVM grew the number of opportunities for students and internships for us to play a big role in that. And so in the college in which we're housed, which is the College of Arts and Sciences, we have been charged with trying to increase the number of students who have internships and also to build some new internship programs that kind of take advantage and allow students to participate in the variety of ways in this state of ours.
Now, Roanne, you had an internship this summer. Explain what that was.
Yes, certainly. So this summer I had an internship doing a couple of different things. First and foremost, I was doing policy research for Representative Carrie Dolan, and I was working on some bills that she's very interested in, just doing research, contacting people around the country who were also involved in that topic. And then I was also the student group leader for the summer. So there were four or five other students also doing policy research for legislators. And it's a much smaller program over the summer, which is why I was able to be a little bit more hands-on and, you know, take charge myself and help the other students with anything that they needed help with. And for me, it was just a really, really great experience being able to have that hands-on work with the legislator themselves and then also working in a small group with other students.
And Emily, are you involved in an internship right now?
Yeah, so I also was involved with the program Rowan did over the summer. And then this semester, I'm also working for Senator Keisha Rand Hinsdale. So I'm doing a bunch of different kinds of work for her, policy research and constituent emails and organizing events.
Now, Richard, when I was an undergrad, internships were rare. And again, that was many decades ago. In grad school, they came at the end of the program. How are internships different today?
That's such a great question. So here's the thing. Internships give students this amazing opportunity to figure out the things they like and the things they don't like and to make those connections and to test the skills and connect them with their classes. And it used to be very much like you said, if you found an internship, you were totally on your own, you know, and you might find a faculty to sponsor it or you might not. But what we're doing increasingly now is we think of internships as just part of your college education. So traditionally at UVM, you take five classes. What you might do is take four classes, and the fifth class is an internship. And then we play a big role in trying to help students find those placements, to support them while they're in them, and then to help them make those the connections that internship will then help them in the next thing they do, because there's all the indications are that these experiences help students get jobs, you know, build those networks that they need, figure out the things they like.
And Rowan, what skills would you say you learned from the internship that you had this summer?
I would say, I learned a lot of hard skills, such as just like the research I was already talking about. So research skills, not just only, you know, where to look in databases on like our library website, but also who to ask outside of that. You know, if I can't find the right answers to my questions, I can, you know, look online and ask around to see if there's other people, experts that I could speak to about a particular issue. I also learned how to write good questions, which I think is a really important thing, not just as a researcher, but in pretty much anything you're doing. I also improved upon my communication skills, written and oral. I did a lot of emailing. I did a lot of phone and Zoom interviews. I improved interpersonal skills. I was, you know, figuring out how to work in a workplace in a small group with other people and also a professional internship. And for me, those are the biggest things and the biggest benefits, and that's what's helped me in my current teaching assistant position for the legislative internship program this fall that Emily is also participating in.
Well, Emily, now what are you majoring in, Emily?
I am a poli-sci and history double major.
And so how do you see this ultimately helping you, being involved in the internship program?
I think that the skills that I'm learning are going to be applicable to pretty much any sort of work that I would go into. Law school is kind of my tentative plan, but I'm trying to keep that open, and I think just learning how to be a better writer, communicator, researcher is just stuff that's going to help me no matter where I go, and it's already helping me with classes now.
Rowan, what are your career goals?
Well, I am graduating at the end of December this year, actually, so I'm graduating a semester early, and after this, I'd really like to work in the policy field. Eventually, I'd like to go to grad school. I'm very interested in international environmental policy specifically, and I really like the idea of being someone who is really active and not necessarily a politician, but somebody who is maybe more behind the scenes, who's writing the bills, doing the research, making sure people are being heard and understood and concerns are being addressed. And so I want to be the person who's actively writing and creating policy that then, you know, later gets enacted.
Richard, what do you look for in the internships that you help arrange for UVM students at the Center for Research in Vermont?
Yeah, great question. So kind of what's happened, by the way, we have as many interns this semester as we used to have 3 years ago in an entire year. So we have almost 300 students who are working in various places, mostly in Vermont. And to grow the program, what's been really effective is to look for places in Vermont that you can scale up internships, but you don't just totally rely on the organization to take on the intern, because that's a lot of work. So what we've done is built these things that we call communities of practice, where there's a professional that we hire and a mentor and often a student leader like Rowan, who then coordinates the students in these internships. And one obvious one has been the legislature. So here we have in Vermont a citizens legislature. They don't have professional staff. And what an opportunity for students to get, you know, hands-on experience working directly with legislators, doing the whole range of things that a legislator might do. And we started that program a couple of years ago with 5 students, and now we have 50-plus each semester, and we're hoping just to keep making that as strong as possible. Another one like that is a brand-new one we started, which is working with small towns. And the pandemic has shown us that you actually can do more remotely. We still want students to go meet with these people, feel what it's like to be in an organization. But we're now able to work with a town in southern Vermont that we hadn't really thought about before. And so we're looking for programs that give students this, what it's like to be in an organization, what it's like to have to be in a workplace, and a place where also they're going to get direct contact with leaders and not be and really experiencing the full range of things that you might do in an organization.
And do students get course credit for the work?
They do indeed. They do indeed. So depending on how many hours they put in, and a minimum we'd like them to do is 120 hours a semester, and that translates into a certain amount of credit. So during the semesters, those credits count towards their graduation and are, you know, increasingly people feel as important as some of the classes are going to take to kind of, to build the skills that they're going to need in this world that they're going into.
Now let's go to the phones. We've got Ted joining us from Shelburne. Hi, Ted.
Oh, hi. Good morning, and thanks. This is just bringing a lot of intersecting positive thoughts here, but just about the value of experiential education and the fact that Richard doesn't know me, I don't think, but I think I'm aware that as a young child, he was, among his acquaintances, were apprentices of his father's. And it's just, you know, the value of this kind of education added to the academics and, you know, the expected usual getting degrees and credits and courses and so on, but the actual stuff, I have thought sometimes in Vermont an advantage we have is that there's a significant portion of farmers and mechanics, and you can't talk your way out of making things work right.
Because right.
You know, when the logic is not correct or when your decisions are not correct, it's obvious and that there's a problem. So anyhow, this is just praise for, and I also, I know you went to college in Ohio. I graduated from Antioch, which has a co-op program where you work and study alternatively.
Yep.
So I'm just putting a pitch in for this experiential education.
That's fantastic.
And also, I will say, because I always do when I call, rootsofempathy.org gives social, emotional, experiential education to very young children in schools.
Yep. All right, Ted, thanks for that. Hey, Richard, you know, the idea of taking an internship while you're in school, how does that enhance, you know, what you're learning in the classes that you take at UVM?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I should turn to Emily and Rowan for a second. And by the way, Emily and Rowan are just great examples, Rick, of exactly what we're trying to do here. Rowan has had a couple of different internships, at least that I know of, in different fields, and has sort of been drawn this way. Emily also has done this and something like it. I think Emily might be from Vermont. Rowan's from Wisconsin. And then here they are both anyway, so let's,
Emily, you first. So how have you seen, you know, what you've learned through, what you've experienced on an internship, how that's enhanced when you're in a classroom?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially for me being a poli-sci major, I'm going to classes learning about how a bill becomes a law, and then I get to go and meet with my legislators and watch the process actually happen. So I think just on a practical level, like getting to physically see these things that I'm learning about happen in real life is amazing. And then on the other side, like all of these skills that I'm learning through my internship are so helpful to me in class and give me context to everything that I'm doing. And also, again, helping with writing and research skills, those help with every aspect of my education.
And Rowan, can you give examples of, you know, maybe something you learned, you know, this summer that, you know, in class you're able to then give great examples or connect to what's being taught in a classroom?
Yes, I think just being more involved in the law process and see how lawmaking is happening, you know, on a hands-on experience. I'm currently taking a couple different classes about law this semester, and obviously they're very basic because it's undergraduate law here at UVM and it's my first time doing it. But I've just gained a greater understanding of kind of what goes on behind the scenes and what people are thinking and how they're communicating and talking to each other. And I think another big part of it as well is just my personal confidence in myself and my leadership skills and communicating with other people and talking to other people was really enhanced over the summer, and it's helped me in pretty much everything I'm doing this semester and especially in my work as a teaching assistant.
Mm-hmm. Richard, you mentioned that some of the students are working with municipalities as interns. So explain what they're doing with some of our towns.
Yeah, a whole range of things, because as you know, Rick, our small towns are so challenged in Vermont. They don't have a lot of staff. They don't have a ton of resources. And so students are doing things from helping with their web pages and making their web pages compliant to helping them think about how to understand these new, enormous new federal monies that are coming down and how they might be allocated in the town, to helping with town communications or research in a project. One project is about understanding who actually owns access to some lakefront and going way back into the deeds or helping towns. There's just so many things. But from our point of view, students being in these places and making these connections and getting the firsthand feel for what it's like to work in these really democratic institutions at the level, small level in Vermont, has just been amazing for the students involved.
Emily, from your internship in the legislature, you know, what are you hearing from the legislators themselves? You with, I think, Keisha Rahm, you know, what does she say about what you're able to bring to her staff?
Yeah, I think they all have found it really helpful. I've worked with a bunch over the past year, and I think they're all super overworked and just sort of looking for any help they can get. And I think they're really appreciative of the perspective that students can offer and just being able to talk with young people and understand what's affecting them, and also just getting to, again, have a little extra help. I think it's been really great for them, and they seem very appreciative and are excited to continue the program.
Yeah, definitely points to the fact that we still have a citizen legislature. These people have full-time jobs and still trying to work in the state house on our behalf. Richard, we have about a minute left, so tell us, you know, what's the future for the internship program for the Center for Research in Vermont?
Yeah, I think there's no end in sight. Vermont is just such a great, accessible place, and we have a lot of organizations that are small, and the idea of bringing these resources, these young people that we have, not just at UVM, but across the state, to help and support and at the same time learn while they're doing it. You know, you mentioned at the outside the reporting program we have, so here's students writing stories for the 30 or so small papers that we have in Vermont, all of whom are struggling to find content, and these students are getting this real-life experience. So I think we see that these programs are just going to keep growing, and we're certainly open to people's ideas or suggestions.
Richard Watts is the director of UVM's Center for Research on Vermont. Rowan Hawthorne and Emily Schefftman are part of the center's legislative internship program. To learn more about the Center for Research on Vermont, you can visit uvm.edu/CIS/Vermont Research. Emily, Rowan, Richard, thanks so much for being on the program this morning.
You bet.
Thank you.
All right, take
care.
All right, news is next. Then we're going to hear about the Flying Ryan Hawks Foundation. And a reminder, we've got the World Series again tonight. Game 2, Braves up now by a game. It's Braves at Astros. Coverage begins at 7:09, first pitch at 8:09. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Now we're getting to learn how, even after a person is gone, their spirit and their love of life can carry forward, how their dedication to a set of core values has led to the creation of a nonprofit that is inspiring others and providing guidance and scholarship opportunities. The organization is the Flying Ryan Hawks Foundation. It's based in Shelburne. And joining me now to talk about Ryan and the foundation is its current executive director, Peter Hawks. Peter, thank you for being on Vermont Viewpoint today.
Well, thank you, Rick. It's a privilege to be here and share with you a bit about what the Flying Ryan Foundation is all about, tell his story.
Great. Listeners, to ask Peter about the Flying Ryan Foundation, you can call us 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Well, let's start with that big question, Peter. What is the Flying Ryan Foundation?
Well, the Flying Ryan Foundation has been around for about 10 years. It was founded in 2011 to honor the life of Ryan Hawks, who was a Vermont boy born in Burlington. And he was a very gifted extreme skier, and he died in competition while skiing in the Freeride World Tour out in Kirkland, California. He just executed a 40-foot backflip, and as they say in that game, he stomped the landing. But unfortunately, there was a submerged rock where he landed, and it took him out. And as I've said many times at that time, we lost his body, but his spirit continues to be a current event. And we started the foundation as a means to extend the impact that Ryan had in his 25 years of life. And to tell you a bit about Ryan, he was born in Burlington, and he attended UVM. It took him 7 years to get through UVM because he never let his passion for skiing basically overwhelm his interest in education. But nevertheless, he ultimately graduated with a degree in mechanical engineering He was just the kind of person that everybody wanted to be around. And not because he did anything, but just because he was there. Everybody thought they were his friend. And in his life, there was no caste system. He was very even-handed. He was really well known for his Chiclet smile. He was constantly upbeat, and he was fun to be around. And he could certainly be the goofiest kid in the room, or he could be very level-headed and serious. And very importantly, there wasn't a mean-spirited bone in his body. You just couldn't get negativity out of Ryan, and that's why people gravitated to him. He's a gifted athlete, a natural leader, passionate about skiing, passionate about the Mother Earth, and he was just a wonderful person to. There was just kind of an aura that traveled with him that made people gravitate toward him. Wonderful kid.
Yeah, I didn't know him. I've seen videos of him, and the way you describe him is really spot on. He had a spirit. He had a joie de vivre and a love for people and for just enjoying life that we, you know, I wish we all could have. So why did you decide, upon his death to start this foundation in his name?
Well, we wanted to extend the impact of his life because he just, you know, with more Ryans in the world would be a better place, you know, pretty simple. We discovered on his computer a couple of months after he died that Ryan had written down his 14 principles for living, not to broadcast to the world. It was a private note from Ryan to Ryan, and I suspect it was sometime after midnight. He was probably listening to reggae on his headphones while he jotted down the ideas that basically came from his core spirit, his gut. He connected his heart with his mind. And it was pretty good stuff. And I think these are worth repeating. So mm-hmm. I'd like to share them with your listeners.
Yeah, please do.
You know, his first rule for living was live every day, all day. And you'll notice in these principles as we go along that there's a verb in every one of them. Because a principle is basically a foundation for subsequent attitude and action. His next one is never stop exploring life. Never lose my adventuresome attitude. Be the best friend I can be. Be the best brother, son, uncle I can. Look out for others. Look out for myself. Look out for our surroundings. Play like I'm 13. I love that one. Be self-sufficient. Don't be afraid to ask for help. Work hard. Live easy. Live simply. Those were Ryan's core values.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's just so we started basically sharing that with quite a lot of success. People really gravitated to those 14 ideas. And what he'd done is he'd managed to connect his mind with his core spirit and his energy. And as we know from physics, energy doesn't dissipate. And it just changes form. Snow changes to sleet, changes to rain. And every one of Ryan's core values had a verb in it because core values really do serve as a foundation of everything you say, think, and do. That's how you engage in life. Well, that's a big deal. That's important stuff. And so we feel that that's a life lesson that Ryan should serve as an example. But his principles aren't the principles that are important. The principles that are important are the principles that people create for themselves and so that they can live in a more authentic way.
Well, as a matter of fact, this idea of core principles is very important, very held dear by your foundation staff members. How have they kept this idea alive?
Well, we've hooked up with the Vermont school system, and the reception by so many people in so many walks of life was so powerful. We wanted to harness that power in some kind of meaningful way. to make the world a better place. So we started by going to Ryan's old high school, South Burlington High School. Mm. And we introduced a program that was called the Flyin' Ryan Decisions Program. It had the full approval of the principal, Pat Burke, and it was facilitated by Ryan's former math teacher, John Painter.
Mm.
And we came into school as part of the sophomore curriculum. The idea was that freshmen are getting acclimated to high school, and juniors and seniors are making critical choices about their future. So from a developmental standpoint, sophomore year was the sweet spot. So we put together a four-step program, and the purpose of the program and the core values was to give students a sense of ownership and self-identity that's authentic. And everything we do focuses on a bottom-up approach to education. Students are on the receiving end of the rules and the regulations and the curriculum, which is largely delivered in a top-down fashion. The teacher has the answers, all the answers. In our program, the teacher does not have the answers. He has no answers. All the answers lie within each student and are provided by each student himself. And each student is asked to connect his mind with his heart and his core spirit. And as I said before, it's a four-step process, and the step one involves John Painter, who's head of the math department, and I introducing the students to Ryan Hawks with a four-minute video. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of this video is to create credibility with the idea that core values are cool. And when we ask the then we ask the students to define core, and the point being here is not to tell them what core means. They tell us. So already they're taking ownership. And then we go on to values and then core values. And when they get done defining those things, we then ask the students to start writing down whatever comes to mind. And we might remind them of two things, that there's no right number for the number of core values in order to so-called be a good person, be your best self, and just make sure that it's authentic, that it comes from you. And so after the students compose their core values, we ask them to illuminate them by turning them into a presentation with pictures and PowerPoints. And this leads to the final component of the program, in which each student invites the people who are important in his life to come to a presentation where he presents to them his academic expectations and his core values. And this is where the rubber really hits the road. When you tell your self-selected peers who you are, you have laid down the basis for the way you're going to be engaging in life, and you've established an authentic foundation for self-respect. It's really a very meaningful event in the high school life of many students.
Peter, flashing back to that nether world of being a sophomore, which is neither, you're kind of betwixt and between, and when someone said, you know, really gives you this opportunity that empowers you at that age, probably about age 14, it sounds fabulous. Do the teachers react with this kind of flipped script?
Well, it's interesting. What the teacher is required to do in our program is give up control of the classroom,
mm-hmm.
and the curriculum. And that doesn't come easy for all teachers.
Right.
But nevertheless, if a teacher goes back to the point and thinks about why they became a teacher to begin with, then they begin to realize and reconnect with the idea that they really want to build a bridge of education with their students that has a meaningful impact and helps their students move forward in life. And so this exercise gives students a voice, an authentic voice, that is also generates a lot of self-respect. When you know who you are and you have your own voice, then you can really speak with authority about how you feel, and armed with self-respect, it's much easier to give respect to your surroundings. Now, going back to the South Burlington High School, about 2,000 students have been through the program over the last 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And most have come in reluctantly because they don't know what's ahead of them. But our exit surveys show that 4 out of 5 students in exit surveys are say they're glad they did it.
Wow.
But far more importantly, about one in five students, it's a major game changer. It has a terrific impact on their subsequent decision-making and engagement in life. And Pat Burke, the principal at South Burlington, is a strong advocate for the program. He said that never in his life as in education has a program had greater influence on the culture and climate of the school. And the success we've had in South Burlington has enabled us to be inserted statewide in an initiative called the Personal Learning Plan, which is required curriculum for all Vermont high school students.
Yeah.
This plan, called Act 77, was passed several years ago and has 3 primary ingredients. And one of those 3 ingredients is that each graduating senior student should have composed a set of core values as a requirement for graduation. Well, that's wonderful legislation, but that doesn't get the job done.
Well, let's hold it right there, Peter, and we're going to come back and address that on the other side of this break. Peter, before the break, I cut you off. I wanted to let you kind of finish your thoughts there.
Yeah, no problem. Well, basically, legislation alone doesn't get the job done.
Yeah.
So we've got a long ways to go. It's been 3 years now. We're in 10 or 12 schools around the state, which means we got a lot more that we should be in.
Mm-hmm.
But we're in some of the big schools, the Essex High School, CVU, South Burlington High School. And I think cream rises to the top, and eventually the Personal Learning Plan program will eventually find its way into literally every Vermont school. And that's our goal, that's our dream, and we're doing what we can to carry the ball and turn it from fiction into fact. And so... and we also know that there are teachers, individual teachers, who are implementing it on their own because they like what it is and what it does.
That's gratifying.
But, So that's where we are in the education community. But there are other ways that we are using the program. And one of them is one of our key programs is a risk management program for skiers.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of acceptance in the ski world because of Ryan's passion for skiing. And we've designed a curriculum which concentrates on risk management for the more than 3,400 members of the International Free Ride Ski and Snowboard Association. This organization orchestrates about 80 big mountain free ride events each year. And for those of you who don't know what free ride is, you basically have a starting gate at the top of the mountain, and you use your creativity and capacity and risk management to get yourself to the bottom with fluidity and style and control and using the terrain and all that kind of thing, and you get judged. But there are about 60 organized programs, largely in the western states, but also in New England and the Midwest. And these programs are coached by 400 certified coaches, all of whom have the Fly and Ryan Decisions Program training as part of their certification. And at major events, we give Fly and Ryan Core Values Awards, which are all based on the idea of outstanding display of character. And over the course of the last several years, these awards have become as highly sought as well as the podium. So we're really penetrating the culture of the Big Mountain free ride ski community. And it carries a vibe that's admirable and reflects a great deal of mutual respect and support among the athletes. And other sports would do well to emulate the example that these athletes set. Brian Salatino is the free ride coach at Smuggler's Notch, and he was instrumental in crafting the free ride curriculum. He now serves as the vice president of the International Ski and Snowboard Association, and he's on the board of directors of the Flying Ryan Foundation. We're grateful for his numerous contributions.
Peter, you've been serving as the foundation's executive director, but you're looking for someone to take over the position. First of all, why is it time for you to step aside?
That's a good question. It certainly has been an exercise in passion on my part and continues to be and will always be. But I've got a limited skill package, and I'm 83. And so when we're talking about high energy and youth, we need to bring somebody aboard who can take what we've developed over the last 10 years in our little foundation and grow it in a significant way. And our opportunity is immense. And so just last Thursday, we put our first ad in 7 days and the 7 day newspaper, and mm-hmm. we put it out on LinkedIn, and we've had over 40 inquiries, 40 resumes come in so far. So, and some of these resumes are mind blowing. And one of the things I've discovered, within this collection of resumes that kind of fascinates me, is that there are several resumes of people who've been very, very successful in life. We have one resume from someone who was running an organization, a $90 million organization, that was taken over by private capital. And he said all his life he's been basically grinding away and chasing dollars, and there was a big hole in his life, and he's really interested in doing something now that's going to make the world a better place, that basically where he wants to get up in the morning and know that he's helping people in a meaningful way. Rather than and money is the least of his concerns, but passion for making the world a better place is what he wants to devote his energy and his skills toward. And so, and we've got other resumes that are equally as compelling. And so, our process is going to be out of this mass of resumes we're getting, we will have an inner circle where we do the vetting, and then we will have a couple of finalists who present to the board of directors. And I think we're going to put the foundation in very gifted hands going forward. And I think we have the opportunity to really push what we do forward in really significant ways. And one of the ways that I haven't really alluded to is that the Decisions Program is really good for a school setting, but it's complicated, and so it's therefore limiting. We just developed a program called the Core Values Program over the course of the last year, where we took the decisions idea and the idea of crafting core values, and we put it into basically a one-click process for the electronic world. You know, PDAs, laptops, or smartphones, or whatever, so that if we can reach people and get their attention, they're one click away from getting engaged in crafting core values for themselves. And I think this is going to give us just a ton of opportunities. For example, in business. Well,
Peter, we're out of time, so what I'm going to do is give people the website address, flyinryanhawks.org, and people can learn more. Peter Hawks is the executive director of the Flying Ryan Hawks Foundation, and again, the website address, flyinryanhawks.org. Peter, thank you so much for being on with us this morning.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, get an update. Then we'll be back to hear from an owner of several Vermont restaurants to talk about what the pandemic has been like for her and her staff. And a reminder that today at 11 o'clock, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. All of us have done a lot of talking about what has happened with, at, and to Vermont's restaurants during the pandemic. Some restaurants closed for a time, some found ways to reopen, while others are now lost to us. Vermonters have a proud tradition of supporting its homegrown restaurants. There's a couple in Essex, Misty and Gary Greenough. They started a Facebook group called To Go Tour that pulled people together to support Vermont restaurants and share great places to eat here in the state. This morning, I'm going to talk to the owner of several restaurants, and she's also a part of a group called Vermont Independent Restaurants. With me is Leslie McCrory-Wells, co-owner of Pizzeria Verita, Trattoria Delia, and Soto Anotka. Leslie, how did I do with pronouncing those names?
I thought you did very well.
All right. Did I get all of the restaurants that you're involved with?
Yes, as my daughter tells me, I'm being generous when I say it's three restaurants. It's actually maybe two and a half, let's say.
All right. Well.
But yes, thank you. You did well.
All right. Well, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint. And listeners, to ask Leslie about what's happening and what it's like owning a restaurant during the past year and a half, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. If you're a restaurant owner, we'd love to hear your story as well. Well, tell us a little bit about the 2.5 to 3 restaurants that you are an owner of.
Okay. Well, Pizzeria Verita was opened by David Abdu, John Rayo, and myself about almost 10 years ago. And now John and I are own that, and we also purchased Trattoria Delia, which at the time was a 24-year-old restaurant that dear to our community. And we purchased that about, as I said, 4 years ago. And with that, Soto Anoteca was the wine bar that kind of was attached to Trattoria Delia, but it has kind of taken on a life of its own. It has its own real following. It's not open right now, but I think we are planning to open that in the next week and a half.
When did you get into the restaurant business yourself?
Well, I think it's always been a job for me since I was about 16. I got my first job at 16. Surprised my dad came home and said, I'm working at a place called Sambo's, and he almost, his jaw dropped open, and he didn't want to tell me I shouldn't be working there, but he said, okay, because he was proud of me for making the effort. And I think I've always sort of worked in restaurants along the way while I was in college. My life partner and I bought what was Purple Knight's Pizza across from St. Michael's Collins. That was our first restaurant that we actually owned. Mm-hmm. And we had that for about 10 years before David and John asked me to jump into this other opportunity, Pizzeria Verita, and we created that.
Well, there are many St. Michael's College students or graduates now and people in the Colchester area, Winooski area, who remember PK Cafe quite well and miss you. What does it take to successfully run an independent restaurant?
Well, I think it takes a lot of grit. It takes a good, solid staff. It takes, you know, a tremendous amount of support, community support, which I think Vermont has done an incredible job of doing. We have, I can say at least from our group that we talk a lot about how the community has really come up and supported us through, you know, all the challenges that COVID has brought to our restaurants. But I think it takes, you know, you really have to be, you know, wear a lot of different hats. You have to be a good coach for your staff, be able to listen and sometimes have some tough love. But I think there also has to be a real passion for the industry. And many times I've actually left the industry, did some work in education, adult education, and a variety of other different jobs. Went back to school to be in education and ended up back in the restaurant business. And a lot of people will say that, people who are in this industry, just there's something about it that brings you back. There's something about that. It's definitely a community-facing industry, and there's something about that connection that brings you back to it.
Right before the pandemic began, a group of restaurant owners formed Vermont Independent Restaurants. So what is this organization?
This organization really came out of an email kind of exchange that started with, I think it started with Courtney Bush, as you'll recall from Butch and Babe.
Mm-hmm.
And she started to email, this was somewhere around the first weeks of March when we were all starting to feel like, okay, things were starting to heat up. We weren't sure what was happening. Like all of us, we were really just confused about, you know, what to do, how to deal with the news that we were hearing. We started to sort of like just start the string of communications between all the restaurants. There are a lot of restaurants. I mean, there are 1,400 restaurants in Vermont. So we just started from, you know, organically from the people that we knew and kept reaching out until this huge email stream was going around talking about, you know, what was everybody doing, comparing notes and how are you, you know, how are you hanging in there? Somewhere around, you know, on the 15th when the closure started, when Governor Scott mandated that the restaurants closed, it sort of became a time to think about, well, what do we do next? And there were, you know, the Vermont independent restaurants, Sue Betty, Jed Davis, a variety of people, a bunch of people, Benji, they all began to talk about how we can create a stronger advocacy group. And that's sort of how it came about. It's an acronym for, you know, VTUR is what we call it, acronym for Vermont Independent Restaurants. It's really a group of eating and drinking establishments that was created in March 2020 out of this sort of industry-wide desire to connect us all and collaborate and share stories and just generally support each other through COVID challenges. And then it became more of an advocacy group, advocating for grants, advocating for the rooms and meals, February, March rooms and meals receipts to be deferred, or actually ended up being not deferred, but we actually did. It was money that we could actually use to keep our businesses afloat. So they've gone on to, and I should say we, I am now on the leadership team with them.
Congratulations.
I didn't really start there. Yeah, it's a wonderful group. Thank you. I think what our mission is really to preserve and advance our restaurant industry, our independent restaurant industry.
About how many members do you have now?
I think at one point we had about 180 members. I don't know how many we have right now, closer to maybe 100. And we're really, the push is to get more members. And again, it's not just about the fact that we want members. It's about the fact that we have, there are a lot of restaurants that have not been really brought into the fold and connected. And maybe don't know all the money that has been available to them, or the pools of support that have been available to them, and we've sort of tried to get a I don't think there's a real good bank of information to get to each one of those. So we're really just trying to get out to everybody and bring them into the fold so that we can work very well together to, again, to support this industry. Because we're really, recovery is so fragile. We haven't even started to fully recover.
Yeah.
I don't think we expect to recover to begin in the restaurant and, venue industry until maybe 2022 if we're lucky, but we have a very long winter ahead of us.
Yeah.
And we can't afford to lose any more restaurants to that. So we're really trying to, again, advocate for each other. I'm not sure of the date, but connected with the Vermont Chamber of Commerce. So to give some strength and some advocacy to the mission. And it's been a great, connection for us.
I hate to do this, but let's flip back to last March, the beginning of the pandemic, the shutdown of your restaurants. How did you start to climb back from that shutdown, Leslie?
Well, the first month, I think, and I think this is probably across the industry, we were trying to get make sure that our furloughed staff members were receiving benefits. So, that was the first month of just trying to make sure that it was hard to get through. And eventually there were more staff members, in the DOL so we could get through with that phone number, and everyone got on and everything was okay. And then we, at our restaurant, we started to think about, well, how can we help our staff members, with food? So we had a donation button on our website, and a lot of, folks in the community donated money to our this effort, and then we would buy wholesale food and sell it to our staff, and also we had free food in different levels depending on whether somebody could pay or not. So they could come to the side door of the Trattoria Deli, and we'd have a package. They would order their food, and we'd have it all packaged up for them, so they could just take it and not have to go to the grocery store. That was how we sort of started. Just helping with a staff sort of commissary. And then we were closed for, about a month and a half, and we opened back up basically takeout and delivery, which is, our pizza is not the best takeout pizza, but our community, our customers were so appreciative and would tell us, oh, no, I just take it home and I throw it in the hot pan and it's perfect. So, and it's funny because, one of the positive things about this is because we were just sort of shy about doing takeout. So our takeout was, we maybe have 11 or, 12 takeouts in a night.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's 25% of our business. And that's, unprecedented numbers for us to do those kind of numbers. But a lot of it is because of the increase in the Delta variant and case counts, but also just people are really, really still supporting us and want the product. So that's been a kind of a plus, a silver lining in this whole thing. So.
What are the challenges you've been facing this year, Leslie?
Well, the challenges are, certainly issues around recruitment and retention have been not as difficult for us. We've had a very great core group that has stayed with us. We've been really thankful to that. But we have had to do some recruitment and have had to keep our, I think one of the difficulties is that we've had to close our restaurant has shrunk down. So we don't have as many seats. We don't have as many, we're not open as many days. So we're open 5 instead of 7. Our hours are shrunk down just to be in the sort of the prime time so that we're not spending money on labor. Number one, it's difficult to find it, but even spending money on labor that we in hours that we're just not completely busy.
Yep.
So, and that's made us more profitable in the time period. It hasn't made us more profitable. It hasn't made us, we're not at the pre-pandemic numbers. But it has made us more profitable in the time that we are open, and it allows us to, really hone in on our costs. But some of the other challenges is just supply chain challenges. You know, our products that we have, you know, basically curated, you know, for their price, for their quality and everything. A lot of those products have been difficult to get. And so we're going to keep high quality products. So that changes the price structure
right.
in a lot of ways. So, but we don't, we're kind of hesitant to raise our prices. And I think this is, this is felt across the industry. You raise your prices in a time it's already difficult for people. And you run the risk of maybe, having some consumer burnout and that in terms of prices. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to, really constantly, navigate that sort of difficulty. And when do you make that decision? I think another challenge is, bringing people on and not knowing how long we're going to stay busy. Because of the Delta variant and the case counts and the winter that is we're facing, we know that things are going to start to shrink again. So as we go inside, we actually are closing our outside patios this week. So we'll be going fully inside. So again, there's an instability that's caused by this uncertainty. And it's, for all of us, we're dealing with burnout from that. both our staff, being really stretched, and management team, and also, the owners are just, you don't know what's around the corner at any given time. And then, one of the biggest challenges I would have to say is just we've gotten some grants. The state has been very, very kind to us. And one of the biggest challenges of VTER right now is besides the staffing and housing shortages and COVID concerns, it's just a fight to keep us all open and thriving. Mm-hmm. Our state congressional delegation, legislators, and community members have remained really supportive and fierce in their desire to see our eateries and drinking establishments open because they do understand that we provide a service to our community. We're working right now on trying to get the restaurant revitalization fund refilled because it was, I don't know if you know much about that, but it was underfunded from the federal government. And 2/3 of the restaurants didn't get any of that money. And it's critical money that's going to push us to the finish line. And so that's one of the biggest, things we're trying to do with VTER and the chamber is to just continually push on this need to keep that front and center. It's kind of, pushed itself behind this this bill that they're working on right now. But I think that hopefully we will get this fully funded and or at least refilled so that restaurants that are in serious need will be able to get some that access to that money.
We've got a minute left, Leslie. This is kind of more industry-wide. We do see staffing shortages. We've all been practicing patience, but I would imagine that's not going to be the case at all times for patrons of restaurants. So what would you like to tell patrons of any restaurant right now about being patient with staff?
I would just say that, be patient. It's again, the staff is, understand that this is not, certainly not anyone's fault that you might have to come in and wear a mask or, we're concerned about our guests. We're concerned about our staff and keeping everybody safe. And the last thing, and we have not had problems with the restaurant industry. There have not been outbreaks in the restaurant industry. So that's been that's a real, that's huge for a restaurant. So just be patient with us. Our rules are in place to keep everybody safe.
Leslie McCrory Wells is co-owner of Pizzeria Verita, Trattoria D'Elia, and Soto Anateca. And she also is a member of the Vermont Independent Restaurants, whose website is VTIR, which is VTIR.org. Leslie, thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care. That is our show for today, Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading the podcast at wdevradio.com. And it is sponsored by the Warren Store. Funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Sangary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.